The three-year-old's autism was so severe, she would cry through hours of yes-no loops. Yes, I want the blanket. No, I don't want the blanket. The antidote her mother discovered was not a drug to feed her. It was a food not to feed her. This discovery leads us to ask, can what we don't eat be an antidote to autism?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1004th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends tuned in way down there in Fremantle who are listening on the streaming as we stream along in the food chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby. Hello, Jason.
Salutations, boss.
Ready to go. Folks, Brooke was diagnosed with autism at the age of 3. She was a child living in her own world with no eye contact with her mother, father, or siblings. There was no interacting with others, no bonding, no playing with other children. Typical experiences that brought joy to the faces of other children brought nothing to Brooke. Her entire play consisted of arranging her toy animals in repetitive, obsessive, particular way. For her parents, though, Brooke's most disturbing behavior was her becoming trapped in yes-no loops. Yes, I want this blanket on my bed. No, I don't want this blanket on my bed. The loops would run for hours, with Brooke crying her way through until she collapsed in exhaustion. Fortunately, Brooke had what few other children with autism have, a mother with a Ph.D. in biochemistry and a will to fight for her daughter's well-being. Dr. Catherine Reed fought the good fight against her daughter's autism and won. What she learned along the way leads us to ask, can what we don't eat be the antidote to autism? Well, here to help us cook up an answer today we have Dr. Catherine Reed, mother of 5, biochemist, and founder and executive director of Unblind My Mind. Dr. Catherine, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me.
Very good to have you. So, mother of 5...
Yes, I have 3 biological and 2 stepchildren.
So that's a handful.
It's very much a handful, and as you can be, I'm very much aware of the mother role in my life.
Okay. Biochemist, that would be a handful.
That is, too. I love that role, too. I have always loved science from an early age and just kind of never stopped.
Mm-hmm. And founder and executive director of Unblind My Mind. What is Unblind My Mind?
Yes, Unblind My Mind is a nonprofit I started as a result of this journey that initially started with my daughter and who was diagnosed with autism. And I realized very fast through my scientific research, this goes way beyond just autism. And it really is about raising awareness of what's in our food. And, you know, as we ask the question of what not to eat, it's very important to ask the question of what do we eat. So it's a balance. And so raising awareness and helping people transition their diet and becoming more aware of what they are eating and what they're not eating is the mission of Unblind My Mind.
Well, Catherine, we always like to ask the hard question, and the hard question is, who pays the way?
Who pays the way for
Unblind Your Mind?
And that's just it. You know, nonprofits, you know, a lot of them are struggling, and so we receive our money through donations, and people do sign up for some of the services that really hold people's hands and help them transition. We think it's as easy as, okay, stop eating this and start eating this. But these foods are engineered to be very addictive, and it's not so simple. And so the parents battle to trying to wean, or even the families, you know, process of weaning from addictive foods is more than just knowledge. It really is understanding the addictive components and helping.
Okay. Now, you're a PhD in biochemistry, but what exactly did you study?
I studied protein chemistry. That was really my focus when I did my PhD. And Then I continued on in biotechnology, where my role was developing protein therapeutics and really looking at, you know, how do these proteins function? How are they stabilized? How are they destabilized? And my whole biochemistry career really has focused the majority on proteins.
So this was right up your alley. But let's go to autism. Let's start with the autism. I have done several shows on autism, and I think one of the most amazing shows that I did was I called it the Amish Autism Anomaly. And whereas, you know, in the general population of the United States, they say somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 in 166 of us has autism. But in the community of Amish, it was 1 in 15,000. And so why is this? What is the anomaly here? Why do we have such an incidence of autism and the Amish have none? So I got to thinking it must be something we're doing that they're not doing. But we're doing so much that they're not doing, so it's kind of a head scratcher there. To what extent are we suffering from autism out there in the world?
Right now in the U.S., it's 1 in 68.
Oops, 1 in 68?
Yes, that's the newest figures put out by Autism Speaks and, you know, some of the bigger organizations looking at autism rates. And it does affect males more than females. And then, you know, in other countries, it's really challenging because the diagnosis process is very different. That it's challenging to kind of compare different mm-hmm. countries with the U.S. I'm more familiar with the U.S.
Does autism have a real concrete objective definition?
Yes. So, you know, the criteria in the U.S. is, you know, very spelled out as to what defines autism. And, you know, they use the diagnostic statistic manual to diagnose.
Okay. So there's a template that they can hold up and look at the template and look at the person back and forth and say yes or no, right?
Correct. And so, you know, social communication and behavioral characteristics mm-hmm. And, you know, having a certain number will define somebody as autism or not.
Well, let's take it back to the personal level. You know, you're a PhD in biochemistry and you have 5 children and your young Brooke is not performing as normal children would perform. Please describe what that meant for you, how you saw that.
Yeah, so this was, so now she's 8 and a half. So this was, you know, about 5 years ago. It became clear that, you know, there was, you know, just emotional struggles. You know, her anxiety was very unable to be calmed, you know, and her sleeping patterns were not what you would consider to be healthy. They were just very disruptive. She would wake up frequently in the middle of the night. It would be hard to settle her down. And the repetitive behavior, you know, I didn't understand what autism was, and then that was, you know, one of the defining characteristics, or, you know, one of the many defining characteristics.
Did you know it was autism, or did somebody else say, you know, Brooke has autism?
Oh, you know, that's that's an interesting. I was one of those mothers that was kind of in denial, like, you know, it's fine, you know, she's just has her quirks and, you know, it'll be fine. And but look at how she's.
That's my child there, you know.
She's accelerating here. And actually, it was my husband who kind of kept saying, you know, something just seems to be amiss. And I think she has autism. So he probably said it a couple of times before I really embraced what that meant. And it was when he put a checklist in front of me that came from the internet, and it then dawned on me. I mean, every single one of these items defined Brooke, and I was like, oh my goodness, we're dealing with autism. I mean, it didn't take me, you know, a doctor or a psychologist mm-hmm. evaluation at that point. It was then so clear, like, okay, now that I know what it is, clearly we are dealing
and
with autism.
You describe some of her behaviors as being trapped in these yes-no loops. What's a yes-no loop?
Yeah, so that was something that we, you know, obviously coined. But when I, you know, work with many that other clients who have children on the spectrum, they get stuck. And so it seemed seizure like, because you can almost imagine that, you know, you have this neurological signaling that just kind of keeps repeating itself. And so while, you know, in seizures, it might be an uncontrolled motor movement, for others, it might be a repetition of a loop of physical, you know, cycling. And, you know, for her, it was this state of indecision where she would just go cycling back and forth, you know, wanting something, not wanting something. And it was very uncalm. And the more she couldn't really process a decision, she became more and more, you know, agitated and uncalm, to the point she was just screaming through these, you know, indecision loops. And so we called it the yes-no, because literally it was like, yes, I want that. No, I don't. It didn't matter what it, you know, was that she wanted.
Oh, my goodness. And here your parents, and you're looking at your child getting locked into this loop of yes-no and screaming and crying. And, oh, my God, what do we do? What would you do out there? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Dr. Catherine Reed. She, the mother of five, the biochemist, PhD, the founder and executive director of Unblind My Mind. Do stay tuned. Don't miss this one.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, young Brooke was diagnosed with autism at the age of 3. This was not like having a cold. This was like frightening stuff, where she would become locked in yes-no loops that would last for hours, and she would have to cry herself out of them. And so mother and father look at this situation, and father points out, you know, this looks like autism. And mother, who is a PhD biochemist specializing in protein synthesis, looks at it and goes, oh, my God, it is autism. So, Dr. Catherine Reed, what do you do?
So, you know, like many scientists, I wanted to tackle the problem and you know, first understand, you know, exactly, you know, what is going on in a brain with autism, and I quickly realized this is not just about the brain. But there were so many other physical.
Just a sec, Karen. Are we on? Okay, go ahead.
There were so many other physical symptoms that she was having too, that just, you know, weren't behavioral. Like a bloated stomach, she just seemed to have issues with her digestive tract, and so I just really started to explore, you know, exactly what could explain such behaviors and physical traits.
And have you been aware of glutamates in the food chain, per se? I mean, had this been a thought to you before?
Not at all. Not
so
at
you
all.
Were not like a foodie in the at all, were you?
I thought I was a foodie, but I was way off. No, so I mean, I thought I was feeding my family healthy at this point, but no, I had no idea that glutamates or MSG were in the food supply to such an extent, and how much I was eating it. So that was really through the journey of starting to explore dietary changes. And every dietary change that Brooke went, I also went through, just to kind of understand what she might be going through, and, you know, if I felt better or worse, so that I could
help. Your other kids had no problems.
And I wouldn't say, you know, no problems. you know, ADHD is something that, you know, we struggled with both our boys. And, you know, while one of them wasn't necessarily diagnosed with ADHD, just very much had some attention issues. I never really had thought about the food to that, you know, at this point. Really kind of thought it was much more, you know, genetic And
sure. So where did you start with respect to food? Why did you start with food?
Because it was something that I could empower myself with and start immediately, because the diagnosis process and trying to get special needs services is a bit of a wait and a process that wasn't going to start immediately.
Oh, so you actually looked at going through conventional medicine thinking, what are we going to do?
And conventional medicine really doesn't offer a lot of answers for this. I mean, it really is, you know, through the mental health approach, and it's through behavioral therapy is the standard of care for autism at this point. And so we were going through that route and trying to qualify for services. But even just, you know, getting a psychologist to evaluate her took some months to get through that process.
And you're a mom.
I'm a mom and I wanted to start. And so I started reading a lot about, you know, brain and nutrition and, you know, what was, you know, optimal nutrients for optimal brain function. And so I started, you know, thinking and resorted to supplements, not knowing better. And, you know, started doing these green smoothies that had, you know, packed full of kale and all sorts of good raw, good, you know, whole food organic ingredients. And there were so many parents that would report some benefit with going gluten casein free. Now, gluten's the, you know, protein found in, you know, wheat and barley, for example.
And you being a protein gal.
Yeah, me being a protein gal, at this point, I didn't understand the connection. You know, casein is a protein found in dairy. And so many people were, you know, commenting improvements. Nobody was saying my child's off the spectrum, you know, by removing these, you know, proteins from the foods. But so many were claiming a benefit that I just decided to try. At this point, I didn't understand. And we saw significant improvements. I mean, still she was on the autism spectrum.
Did you see any improvement with the supplements?
Yes. So just with supplements, we started to notice improved eye contact. And, you know, it was very minor, but, you know, 3 weeks following, you know, the supplements and the green smoothies, we started the gluten casein-free diet, too. So there wasn't much time in between there. But we did notice, you know, even with supplementation, some, you know, improved communication because of eye contact, obviously.
Mom the detective's going, it's working. Something's going on,
right? But, you know, clearly we were dealing with so many issues that, and then even going gluten casein free, we did that stage for about 6 months, so we really got a good baseline. And we noticed improvements, but she still required special needs education, and she didn't appear to be a child that was catching up with her peers and a lot of, like, the social, the communication and language. But the improvements put me on the path. Like, what is it with these proteins that so many people are observing a benefit, and the proteins are from, you know, very different foods. The structure, the three-dimensional structure was different.
And, of course, who in the world would know the least bit about the structure of proteins and the synthesis thereof, except for a PhD biochemist who specializes in protein synthesis. So you're looking at, all of a sudden, the things that you've been studying all your life.
Right. So I focused on, you know, protein structure, which is what my education was in, and the primary structure, which is the amino acids. The amino acids are what are the building blocks of our proteins.
Right.
And that's where I noticed a common thread between the class of gluten proteins and casein, is that they contain a lot of glutamate. Glutamate is one type of amino acid found in proteins. But these proteins aren't consumed in our diet in a raw state, meaning, you know, they're not necessarily intact or bound glutamate. And when I started looking into the fermentation processes, for example, I realized that...
Now, when you're talking about fermentation processes, what processes are those?
Yes, and so that's when we add, you know, cultures such as bacteria cultures or yeast cultures to food and ferment them. For example, that's how bread is made, and, you know, that's what gives the rise of bread. So it starts to create carbon dioxide in there and makes the bread all nice
bubbly,
and puffy.
Bubbly, yeah.
But there's an entire science there that they select cultures with proteolytic activity, meaning it actually digests the protein for its fuel, creating a lot of free amino acids.
And it frees it.
And so it started to dawn on me that, wow, you know, this is no longer protein. And, you know.
So are they kind of like pre-digested then?
Exactly. It's pretty much pre-digesting your food. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, so they're metabolizing it, you know, but yeah, essentially they're digesting it. And I stumbled upon this blog from a parent that said, you know, it wasn't about just removing gluten and casein, but about removing MSG. And honestly, my reaction at that point was, well, who the heck would be feeding their kid MSG? But that the whole thread started to come together when I started looking at the manufacturing processes of food and then, you know, going into the scientific literature to say, is there an association with glutamate, a neurotransmitter, and neurological disorders?
So, as you're doing this research, your daughter is going through these yes-no loops. Was there a certain amount of panic going on with the parents then with respect to these yes-no loops?
Yeah, panic. I mean, it was so dysfunctional. There was, I mean, the way I would define the family at that point was complete chaos. I mean, to have these, you know, horrible episodes go on for hours and hours of a day of just screaming unrest with the child. I mean, she looked like she was in pain. There was just such a uncalm about her, like she was so uncomfortable in her own skin. And it was devastating to see your child go through that. And it would almost be more of a determination in me to find out what is the root cause of this. You know, what can be explaining this?
Digging down from food all the way down to amino acids, way down to the base of life, right?
Yes. And, you know, the whole concept of the associations of behavior and food became what I really focused on. And it became, you know...
Okay, folks, when we get back, what happened to the yes-no loops? How did we get out of the yes-no loops? How did we literally save the life of our child? What did we do? Oh my goodness, this is The Food Chain. Catherine Reed, right back. Well, folks, we're picking it up where we left off, which was we have a 3-year-old daughter who's suffering from autism. To the extent that she traps herself in yes-no loops and can't get out until she balls herself to sleep. Parents looking at her, what are we going to do? Mother happens to be a PhD in biochemistry with a specialist in specializing in protein synthesis. And she's looking and looking and looking at how we metabolize proteins and where they come from. And when did you start thinking that something was amiss with respect to our proteins consumption?
And it wasn't necessarily just protein consumption, although that is part of the equation that I can get into, but how the food was being engineered and processed. And, you know, upon, you know, this, you know, parent on a blog kind of inserting the idea about MSG and then going into the scientific literature to say, is there any scientific rationale that free glutamate could cause, you know, neurological issues or behavioral issues? I honestly felt like I hit the mother load. The science.
Now, glutamates get free how? Because glutamates are endemic in the food chain. They're everywhere.
Yeah, so you have glutamate that's bound in a protein, and it becomes free either through the processing of a protein or through additives, and in both contribute. And what I was about to discover, and this is where it took me beyond, you know, the science, it had to be more detective work, is MSG is often not labeled on our foods. In fact, about 1% of the time is it really labeled as monosodium glutamate or MSG.
1%?
1% of the time. And that's because there are so many creative ways to generate or free glutamate from the processing of food. So whether it be a chemical process, a fermentation process, and, you know, the patents on food processing reveal the extent to which, you know, our food is engineered to liberate or free glutamate from a protein. And, you know, in the U.S., and it is becoming worldwide, we've become obsessed with protein fortification of our food. And if it's not intact, meaning, you know, it's all of the amino acids are bound together, you start to increase the amount of free amino acids. And glutamate is one of the most abundant amino acids in a protein. And so you're creating a lot of free glutamate and taxing our system. And now we need glutamate as part of our regular metabolism, but we need it at homeostatic balanced levels.
Uh-oh.
Yes.
What does balance. That mean?
Yes. Homeostatic means there's a balance. And I mean, so, and the levels of glutamate, if they're not, you know, balanced, where the excitatory, which is, you know, it's a neurotransmitter, so the excitatory pathway is not as balanced with the inhibitory neurological pathway, you get excess. And excess is not homeostatic. It's not balanced. And the excess can lead to all sorts of chronic illnesses and goes way beyond autism.
So, and you talked about inflammatory diseases especially.
Yes. So, you know, glutamate is a neurotransmitter.
What is a neurotransmitter?
A neurotransmitter is it activates the neurological system. So we've got glutamate receptors all over our bodies. And these receptors are activated by glutamate. And these receptors actually have a number of different functions. But one of them is to activate a neuron signaling. And the neuron is actually, you know, one of its purposes to kind of, you know, transmit a signal or communicate with different regions of the body. So, for example, our gut to our brain, you know, it's a communication signal. And if received in excess, meaning, you know, high amounts, that signal or communication is stress. And that's what initiates the inflammatory response. So the neurological inflammatory, you know, pathways are
connected. And inflammatory responses result in?
Inflammation and immunological activation. And so, you know, acute inflammation is, you know, typically a stress response that the body, you know, hey, send some helpers down here. We've got to get rid of this invader or we got to get rid of this toxin. But chronic inflammation is what many people are struggling to fight against. And that's just chronic stress on the body. It takes a lot of nutrients to try to deal with chronic inflammation, and it's, you know, creating all sorts of issues with our permeability of our intestinal barrier, our blood-brain barrier, our intestine or our cell walls. It's wreaking havoc all throughout our system.
So, now, monosodium glutamate was invented about 100 years ago by a Japanese chemist, and he discovered that it gave us a taste of savory in foods, and that we could use monosodium glutamate to make foods that come from a long ways away taste like they come from very close, or make bad foods taste good, or make marginal foods taste good. And so essentially, they kind of allow us to take the food out of food and replace it and still have the taste. Is that a fair way of expressing it?
Yes. With globalization of food, there was a lot of loss of taste that, you know, was a part of the natural food. And in order to put the palatability back in foods, they discovered that MSG actually makes food more palatable. And, you know, so obviously, you know, that's a big, huge, you know, marketing tactic for foods is to, oh, we want our food to be palatable. We want it to be addicting so that people can, you know, continue to consume it. So you get your customers coming back.
And you're looking at this, making this connection. Did you see the connection with respect to your daughter's yes-no loops and the emotional trauma that she was going in as being a response to free glutamates running amok in her body?
So when I started doing the scientific, you know, literature research and thinking about the neurological signaling and like her brain was stuck, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, when I then, you know, I'm stumbling upon glutamate, neurotransmitter, excitatory neurotransmitter, absolutely, I was thinking, gosh, this is possible. So before I had taken on the whole, dietary transition, I'm convincing myself through the scientific literature, wow, this is absolutely plausible that, you know, excessive MSG could be causing these yes-no loops or behaviors.
By then you realize that MSG was kind of pervasive in the food chain, and it's not just something that you get at the Chinese restaurant.
Yes, at this point I'm realizing, you know, by going through all the patents and food processing, that I had to get rid of 90% of my food. 90% of my food, even though I was already gluten casein free at this point, we went through our pantry almost every single commercial salad dressing, sauces, condiments had some sort of ingredient that contained MSG.
90% of the food in your refrigerator and cupboards?
Yes, it was sad. It was a sad day, yes. Yes.
Now, so was there one day when you just woke up to that, oh, my God, this is what we have to try?
It pretty much was one of those things. I woke up and said, you know what? I'm convinced myself through the science that this is worth trying.
And what did your husband say?
Oh, he was mad because I was taking away his favorite cereal. No, he, at this point, he was not convinced. He was like, you know what? This is not a behavioral issue due to food. This is genetic. And, you know, I think you're going to be punishing our daughter by taking away some of the foods she loves.
Wow. Which is it, folks? Is it food? Is it genetics? We're going to find out when we come back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Dr. Catherine Reed. She, the mother of five, the biochemist, PhD, the founder and executive director of Unblind My Mind. Right back. Well, the government says it's safe. Monosodium glutamate has been studied. The interesting thing I learned in considering monosodium glutamate is that it was never really much a part of the food chain here in the United States until World War II. When our side discovered that the Japanese K rations or military rations tasted better than ours did. And when they looked into it, they realized that it contained monosodium glutamate. And so the food industry went, wow, look at this. It can make K rations taste good. It must be pretty good. And so in 1959, the federal government gave it its GRAS state category, which means generally recognized as safe. And there's been a number of studies that say monosodium glutamate truly is safe because it's everywhere. It's in mother's milk. Why can't it be safe? How do you respond to all those studies, Catherine Reed?
Yes. I have looked at a lot of the MSG safety studies and, you know, just kind of evaluated, you know, how were these studies conducted? Most importantly, who's funding these studies? And, you know, I discovered that the majority, if not all of these safety studies were funded by International Technical Glutamate Committee or Glutamate Association, which is a huge, you know, committee and association that receives its money from the food industry that supports putting MSG mm-hmm. in food. And, you know, these are sometimes conducted by these independent researchers by very reputable institutions.
Well, you're a PhD biochemist. How much does it cost to do a study?
It costs, you know, and it depends on the number of people that they put in a study, but it can cost easily $1 million to conduct a study that has, you know, statistical power to really differentiate, you know.
It's legitimate. So we're talking $1 million. So we're talking anybody who's going to fund a study is not going to be me.
Correct. You know, so this is very hard for somebody, you know, like an organization of Unblind My Mind to say, I want to actually go out and conduct a study where it's not conducted by an allergist, which is, you know, one of the more recent studies was conducted, you know, looking, you know, by allergists. This is not an IgE-mediated reaction. This is a neurological reaction. This is an inflammation reaction. They're looking at the wrong system. So when you're looking at the wrong system, it's kind of like looking for a digestive issue by a heart surgeon. You know, you really have to be looking in the right place. And so when I looked at the studies, you know, so one, you know, they're looking for IgE mediated reactions. Another, you know, when they looked at the MSG challenge compared to the placebo, they were only separated by 24 hours, you know, and in working with my daughter and other clients, you know, the reactions after an MSG exposure, the worst of our reactions would happen 24 to 48 hours after exposure, which made it very challenging to kind of figure and sort this out. But, you know, clearly in these safety studies, when they have only 24 hours separating the challenge versus the placebo, they were confounding the reactions.
So how did you know? I mean, when you were looking at your daughter, you were seeing reactions that were taking place a couple days down the line, and you look at her, well, what did she do today? And there, you couldn't see anything. So that's kind of difficult territory.
It was. And, you know, when we went through the whole, you know, let's remove all MSG and give this, you know, a try here, you know, then it became like night and day. We could realize when exposures had happened, and we would then just kind of sort back when did the incident.
Now, MSG in its various forms, and there are many forms, I guess, what, 50 different ways of putting MSG in the food without labeling them as MSG?
At least. Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways.
So pretty much whenever you go out to dinner at a restaurant, whenever you eat at an institution, whenever you buy food that has been processed, whenever, it's everywhere.
It really is. I mean, it what it requires is, you know, going back to eating whole foods that are not processed and nutrient-rich, and eating the right proportions of foods that we're not creating abundant amount of free glutamate from fermentation in our gut with our microflora, which is a whole other topic.
A whole other topic, the right proportions. Oh, my goodness. And that's a hugely significant one. So you're convinced now that the problem is in the free glutamates caused by MSG, but caused by a bunch of other things that are not said on the label there. And you're looking at this and you're telling the family, we're going to make a huge change. You look at your kitchen, you look in the cupboards, you look in the refrigerator, 90% of the food in there. And so you went to war.
I did, you know, so that, you know, coming up with a transition plan and coming up with, you know, meals and food, you know, that,
And you're a mother of five. You're not just feeding yourself.
Yeah,
you're looking at a mother of
little,
five.
Yeah.
It was a five hungry kids.
Yeah, it was quite the transition. And you know, but I just felt like, okay, let's just give it, you know, let's give it a try. If it doesn't work, fine. We'll go back to, you know, I'll give my husband his cereal back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I felt like, you know, what's the worst that can happen here? You know, really, I'm advocating getting rid of a lot of the processed foods, just, you know, replacing it with nutrient-rich whole foods.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to take your daughter on a journey, but you're not going to take your daughter on a journey. You're going to take the whole family on the journey of food, and you're taking out all of the sources, so the processed sources of free glutamates. There will be glutamates in your food, but they will be natural glutamates that will be processed by the body's digestive system.
Right. So the, you know, the bound glutamate in proteins in a whole food would be accompanied by, you know, other nutrients too, like, you know, the fiber and the vitamins and
okay,
minerals.
Folks, when we get back, what happened to baby Brooke when we took the MSG out of her food? Did she survive? Right back. Well, how did baby Brooke do? 3 years old, suffering from what I'm sure her parents considered to be a rather tough case of autism. So tough that she lived in a world of her own, all locked up inside of herself, with no ability to even look you in the eye?
No, initially she was not, you know, looking us in the eye. There's no eye contact. So this is, you know, 5 years ago.
And but locked into these incredible loops. So you looked at the situation, and had anybody ever talked to you about it being a problem with free glutamates? I mean, did you see anything in the literature that said this could be a problem of proteins running amok?
No, absolutely not. In fact, you know, it's, you know, despite the fact that the glutamate blocker drugs are a, you know, billion-dollar industry, you know, with all sorts of illnesses from Alzheimer's to autism, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, migraines.
So we know that the glutamate, free glutamates are a big problem if we're making billions of dollars a year by making drugs that block them.
Right. So there's clearly a recognition that glutamate excess is an issue, but there's not this big, huge limit link that the association is it's coming from the food. It's almost like we've all of a sudden just started had this excess in our system. But, you know, as we all know, we are what we eat, and that excess, you know, could be coming from our food or certainly initiated from our foods.
So you threw 90% of the food out of your house, and what happened?
Brooke is amazing. You know, so 5 years later, she is completely mainstreamed, you know, no assistance needed. She's in second grade doing fine. And you would never, ever know that this child was on the autism spectrum. And she's no longer considered on the autism spectrum. So we were able to recover her completely. And, you know,
what about you?
My health has absolutely improved. I got rid of all my pollen allergies. I used to suffer these low-level headaches from sinus pressure. That's been completely eliminated. You know, I feel just energetic. I feel great. And, you know, I realized that, yes, this is absolutely way beyond just autism. It really has to do with just our, you know, metabolic and neurological balance.
Our communal falling apart.
Yes.
How about the rest of your family?
So, you know, some of the older kids are now out of the house and on their own. They all, you know, adopt the, you know, their health and, you know, the foods that they eat in their own little ways. But absolutely, they have grown and they've seen their sibling or their sister, you know, just transformed by the foods they eat. So there's no doubt that that's always a pressing thing on their mind. My eldest, you know, who's now studying abroad in Ireland right now, probably adheres to it the most. I mean, she absolutely is, you know, realizes that she doesn't feel well if she doesn't eat, you know, and she comes home from college and says, "Mom, detox me, get me my smoothies."
So, your advice?
You know, my advice is, you know, for people to, you know, really stick to nutrient-rich whole foods. Fibers must be in excess of proteins or you can start to ferment.
Fibers must be in excess of protein.
Yes, and this has to do just with the whole fermentation that goes on in our large intestine from our microbiome or our microflora. We want them to, you know, ferment fibers, not protein, because the same thing that they're doing in the industry with fermenting proteins, you know, in the process and in the manufacturing of the foods can also, you know, create toxins in the gut.
Okay, folks, I have an assignment for you. This is from Michael Olson, host of the Food Chain Radio program. Your assignment is to go to unblindmymind.org. Click on the video there and meet Dr. Catherine Reed and her Brooke. Oh my goodness, you will be blown away. Thank you for tuning in. Remember, Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.